News Talk Breakfast.
In association with AIR. Do anything, anywhere with high-speed 4G mobile data coverage across 96% of the population.
This is News Talk.
Well, this week it emerged that a fifth of 16 to 21-year-olds spend more than 6 hours on their smartphone every day. I have to say it didn't come as a surprise to me because I went and checked my average screen time and it was 5 hours 41 minutes last week, so that's probably not too good. But anyway, the research from Young Social Innovators and Amarok found teenagers spent an average of 4 hours per day on their smartphone. Only 3% of our teens spend an hour or less on their phone. So what effect is this phone use having on our young people's mental health? And is it just a normal part of being a teen in the modern world today? Well, I'm joined in studio by one of the country's foremost mental health advocates, Niall Breslin. Hi, Niall. How are you?
Hello, how are you?
Thanks a million for coming in. First of all, what do you make of this survey, the phone use teenagers glued to their phones?
First and foremost, I'm not for a second surprised. But I think we have to go under it and we got to get more layered to why young people are, and as you said, 5 hours yourself, why we're going down this road. And I think there's a duty of care to actually talk about this because we keep talking about the problem, but we don't keep looking at why this problem is happening. And one of the areas that we have to look at with phone usage and apps is, the neuroscience behind it. What happens in the brain when you use these apps, when you get these likes, when you get these validations and instant gratification and all these things, and the psychology of that. Because it's irresistible to the brain. The brain, it's irresistible to get those likes and you get those dopamine. And there's a major company in America called the Dopamine Labs, and their job is fundamentally to make you addicted to the phone. And the very famous point is the CEO of Netflix saying that their biggest competitor in the world is sleep. So these products are addictive. Let's make no qualms about it. And the other thing is they're not going away. I do not believe in the censorship approach, taking phones off kids. We've created this now and we have to figure out a way of navigating it. And modernity has always had things thrown at us in the past that we struggled with initially, but we do not have the luxury of ignoring this.
And when you say at the start going down that road, do you view that to be a bad road? Do you see teenagers on their phones for 6 hours a day a problem?
Of course it's a problem, but when I was growing up there was problems with being a teenager as well. There's always problems when you're growing up and you're developing and you're trying to figure out how this world works. One of the areas I truly believe we need to start looking at is proper media and digital literacy training. It's essential that we understand how all this works. When you say to a young person, do you know the reason you're addicted to Snapchat? It's because it's addictive. It actually has the same neurological responses as perhaps drugs would have. This dopamine response, we have to wake up to this. But the thing about it is, the last thing young people need is old people like me telling them what their problems are. We need to ask, we need to find out, we need to figure out why. And there's so many layers to this that you're never going to get through it in one conversation. I think we need to start looking at this very, very seriously, because like if you break it down to not even the mental health but the emotional intelligence aspects of this, most of our communication is now done online. There's a very famous research by Albert Mehrabian where he says, when I speak to you here now in face to face, you only ascribe 7% of meaning to my words and the other 93% to my tone of voice and my body language. And body language and tone of voice is crucial for communication. It's really, really important, especially if the area is nuanced and sensitive, like many of the social movements we've had in Ireland. You cannot have these conversations online. They do not develop your emotional intelligence, your empathy, your gratitude. These are essential parts of being a human.
Interpersonal relationships.
Absolutely crucial. And in 20, 30 years when robots are doing all our jobs, this is the one thing we have over them. And it's really important. But I think, like, when you look at that from a communication perspective, one thing I got a bit lost on my phone for a few years and I started doing a bit of work on my own head and I realised I need human interaction. I need to be around people. I get a lot from being around people. I love talking to people. But what else has happened online is we've created this really, really quite frightening binary society where we just have people who roar at each other and scream at each other if they don't agree with each other. You cannot have these nuanced debates online. And young kids are getting kind of brought into that as well, and 16 to 21-year-olds, where it's really crucial because that's the time in their life when they're really trying to figure out what they want to do, where they want to go, and how they want to do it. We have to start looking at solutions here. But there's really, really layered psychology to this. And I give you an example. with the way the modern world's going, the last local elections, I never heard, maybe I'm wrong, but I didn't hear any politicians speaking about AI, machine learning. This is going to change our society. It's going to make Black Mirror look like Peppa Pig.
But they probably don't know about it.
But they have to know about it. They create policies that affect our future. And they have to know about this stuff. This stuff is real. It's happening. And it's important that we grasp it. And so look, you look at the social media. Once AI starts building, and AI could be massively beneficial to society. It could help in health. It could help in all sorts of issues. But my fear is sometimes really positive potential progress has not been used for the good of humankind by powers that be. And that's what we have to look at.
The teenagers using the smartphones 6 hours a day, it's arguably something that's going to get worse, because if you think about all of the things now we have to do on our phone, like if you go to a queue in a shop, a lot of people are paying by their phone. Mm. So how you function day to day really now relies on your phone. Is this something, could we be seeing teenagers using 7-8 hours a day on their phone?
We will. There's no doubt about it. That's the way society's going. The fact that you know, in China now you pay for your food with your eyes. It's the way the world is going. It's moving very fast. And in the podcast, we speak about Frankenstein. And Frankenstein's a warning about reckless progress. What's happened is from a... If you talk to any kind of people who have backgrounds in neuroscience, they're saying, often you hear the saying, we have an old brain for a new world. Our brains haven't figured out how fast this is all moving and the amount of information that we have to consume. And what's happening is, because our brain is always in the red zone, the amygdala and the limbic system, we go into these modes of hyper arousal, which isn't a good thing, and anxiety. And it's becoming a default setting. And unless we start doing something, and the thing that's really important, we point this out, it is in education, but it is not the commit. Our teachers need to be resourced here. They're not resourced. We keep doing these small changes in the education system, and that's grand. It's a box tick, but we need an overall of this. Teachers need training and help and support. They need to be resourced. And also parents. Parents don't need to be lectured. They don't need any of this stuff. This is frightening all of us. We're all in this mist of what's going on. So telling a parent to stop letting your kid use their phone is pointless. Pointless thing to say.
You go into a lot of schools, you talk to young people probably every day of your life and the work that you do. What do they say to you about social media and the impact it has on them?
You're going to get different stories. You're going to get different, it's very subjective to people. Some young kids are very, very good at it. Some young kids have very healthy relationships with their phones, good boundaries. They know when they read something, whether it's true or not. Other kids don't have it. And young people can get a bit lost. I mean, you know, breaking down cyberbullying, it's a petrifying area that I really am looking a lot of the research on, and it scares me. The thing about it is, there isn't a hell of a lot of research here, because this is a new phenomenon and scientific research takes time. My concern is, I don't see a lot of, maybe I'm wrong, I don't see a lot of research in the area coming. And it's something we have to look at, because we really don't know what's happening in the brain fully with this aspect. But with parents, I would say, around using the phone, kids are very, you know, they say, they do what they see, you know, and there has to be a relative role model approach here. But I can't speak from some kind of hierarchical place, because I find myself, even though I'm fully aware of how addictive it is, I'm fully aware of how bad it can be if I'm not interacting with people, I still get pulled down that rabbit hole. And I don't have the solutions or answers, but we're going to have to figure them out.
The survey also looked at not just how regularly they use their phone, but also the impacts of social media. And 1/3 of those who were surveyed, these 16 to 21-year-olds, said that beauty standards on social media make life harder now than it was for their parents. Can you see that on Instagram and the pressure that can have on young people?
Of course. I mean, the thing about that has always existed from... Since marketing and advertising has started, we've always created these kind of, beacons of beauty that are generally, for most people, impossible to reach. The problem is the level of it, the consumption of it now. You're seeing it consistently, relentlessly, all the time. Back in the day, you might saw it on an ad when you're watching TV with your parents.
Or a movie
or something. And that was part of it. And you were almost able to decipher the difference between, right, that's a movie, that's Hollywood, and your real life. But now it's becoming more and more difficult, because fiction is replacing fact, not just in online, but generally in politics and democracy and all these things. Mm-hmm. So young people are, of course, they're overwhelmed, but we have to ask why. I keep hearing people talk about this area, but they're not actually getting into the depths of it. Things like rejection. A big issue with young people is porn. It's something we have to start addressing. I know some people are, but it's a huge problem, because that creates impossible standards that are just not true. But the beauty area for me is, are, you know, the highlight, judging yourself from the highlight reels of other people is not a good way to go for your mental health. And much of what I look at is things like Buddhist psychology, and that's, you know, Buddhist psychology has never been more relevant than it is now. And kind of one of the areas is like, our, most of our suffering comes from wanting to have something in a different way, wanting to have, comparing ourselves, judging ourselves. And what happens then is we replace things like the great stuff we actually do have in our lives. We bypass that and we don't see that. And we put all the emphasis on the stuff we don't have. And from a neuroscience point of view and a mental health point of view, that has a direct impact on how your brain operates.
But when you look at Instagram, take it as an example, the most popular pages, not just for girls, but for boys too, are personal fitness pages, modelling pages. I mean, talking about the boys, like a lot of the big male following on Instagram is for these bodybuilders who, that's their full-time job, is Absolutely. To be in the gym. They don't do anything else. But that's fine, and that can be a positive or negative influence. Why are the boys liking the pages? Why are they following them?
Because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it is in within our basic human want to kind of have something to aim at. You know, these, I think the issue you have, we talk about corporate social responsibility. When you're in a corporate company or any business, I think we have to look at kind of influencer social responsibility. Some influencers are really, really good. They're really proactive around it and they really try to do things. Others aren't. Others don't understand. They don't know what to do. The influencing world is part of our modern world too. We have to go with this. It isn't going to go away. It is just what it is. So teaching young kids, one of the issues that I get with young men that I'm quite scared is the increase in steroids. Mm. Now, you want to talk about mental health. If you're abusing steroids and what they are and what they do to your body because you want to look like somebody on Instagram, the information needs to be put out there to young men that this is not a good route to go. But also, if you look at something like Love Island, which has been the biggest TV format in the last 5 years, I think it was 2 years ago. So the format for Love Island, I've watched it for research purposes once. It's generally really good looking people with great bodies, yeah, shifting the faces off each other.
Wearing very little clothing.
And that's what it is. And it's, you know, the format is, and having done TV, it's all set up. It's all producing, say this, do that, react that way, get them hooked. It is TV. TV's always been that way. 2 years ago, Ofcom in the UK had to make an official complaint because ITV decided to put, thinking it was okay to put cosmetic surgery ads on during Love Island. Now, that's not even subtle. Mm. That is cynical. That is wrong at every level. And this is what they're bombarded with. I can't, for example, another thing from, you're watching young people who don't even watch sport anymore for sport. They watch it to gamble. I can't watch anything on TV anymore, any sporting event, without three gambling ads and a famous actor telling me to gamble. These are serious problems, but they're not going to go away. So we have to train people and educate people that the reason they're doing this are for one reason and one reason only, audience and money.
You mentioned likes there. Mm. On my Instagram yesterday, I got a note came up to say that they're trying this test in Ireland where you're not going to be able to see how many likes people's pictures get. You can only see how many likes you get. Mm. Now, is that a positive move from Facebook, which owns Instagram, or is it in some way cynical? They're saying they want to make the experience better. The idea behind it is that maybe you'll start not comparing yourself to others if you can't see how many likes, but you can still see how many likes you get.
I mean, from a personal perspective, I think it's a very positive move by Instagram.
Do you?
Yeah, I think it's a positive move to do that.
You're not cynical.
I'm always cynical to a point, but like at the end of the day, when you realise with social media platforms, with media in general, like let's call a spade here. I'm on a radio show. The bottom line in media is audience. And there's a war for people's attention. And the media, because of new media and traditional media, are in a war together to try and get that attention. Yeah. And they will do anything it takes to get that attention. That is just a reality of a commercial world. We all know that and we have to call it out. There's nothing wrong with it. But the reality is, the collateral damage is the fact that we don't know that that's the way it is. So we're getting sucked into it. Instagram, Facebook, their bottom line is audience and data. Data is the new oil. It's worth more than oil. And this is other things. We have to teach people around data and data protection.
Have you watched The Great Hack?
I nearly had my first panic attack in 6 years watching it, even though I know it's happening. But we need to wake up to this because there's a brilliant book, I can't remember pronounce the name, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. And it's basically about AI and what's going to happen and how it's going to happen. We need to wake up. I keep watching governments and politicians speak about everything except what's going to have a huge impact on our society in the next 10 years. It's automation, AI, machine learning. we have to cop on. So all these issues we're seeing with social media now are going to get progressively worse if we don't get brave and we don't be so myopic, and we start looking long-term strategy of how do we deal with this? How do we better take care of our youth? And one massive word of advice I'd give to everybody is, including the media, including everybody else, stop labelling them snowflakes. They're the first generation that are addressing the stuff that my generation wouldn't address and many other generations above me wouldn't address. They're not snowflakes, they're humans, and they're trying to change things. And they're the only group I can see in society showing leadership. But in this situation, we have a responsibility as adults to figure out what we can do to facilitate and help them to make sure that they can navigate this absolute chaos that we're all living in. But at the end of the day, they can. We can if we get brave and we start doing things.
How is your new podcast going? It's called Where Is My Mind? And for people who haven't heard the podcast, what can they expect from it? Lots of discussions like this, talking about the research, talking about solutions. Is it just you or are there others on it?
Yeah, we have others. We have some incredible people on it. It's also a mindfulness program. It's a 6-week mindfulness program. I just finished my master's in mindfulness and I wanted to get that out. A lot of people have a lot of fear around mindfulness and meditation. They don't know what it is. There's a lot of information. It's been slightly commodified in the Western world. So what I do is break it down to really understandable, relatable ways to do it. And anybody can do it. I speak with it in the podcast. I speak to some amazing people. And the reaction has sincerely been, you know, it's a lot of work and it has blown my mind. It's been really, excuse the pun, but it has been worth it.
Just finally, you mentioned there at the start that, you know, you yourself even struggle with phone usage and all of that. Would you recommend, have you tried this, a sort of a digital detox where maybe don't look at your phone for a weekend, see how you get on?
Yeah, I've done it a few times and it does help. But the problem is what happens is you get back to your phone and that dopamine release happens again. And then you're on your phone for 3 hours. So we do that kind of, okay, I went off my phone for two days, so now I can go on it for 12 hours today because I didn't use it for 2 days. That's not how this works. A great way to do it, a thing that I do is, I obviously, like yourself, I have screen time. And what I do is every hour I use my phone every day, I have to do 15 minutes of meditation. And that's anything of just sitting with myself and not needing to be entertained, just sitting with myself and sitting with my breath. And giving my absolutely mad mind a bit of time off just to have no effort.
Can I ask you, just you mentioned there about the mindfulness program and meditation. Some people find it very hard to do meditation. Mm-hmm. And actually, when you can't do it, is probably when you should be doing meditation. Yeah. How do you crack into that?
Okay, well, first and foremost, I was that person. I have general anxiety disorder and panic disorder for years. Every time I concentrated on my breath, I would panic. I get overwhelmed by it. And then a friend said to me, it's been around 2,500 years, so there's probably more to it. And what I do in the podcast is I start talking about the principles of practice, the things you need to apply every time you sit with practice. And the more you start applying them, the more and easier it gets. For some people, this doesn't work, you know, and you need to reckon. And other people, we've done this thing with mindfulness where we're like, it's the great panacea to getting you to be chill. It's not about relaxation. It's about, for me, being able to sit with yourself, even the stuff that makes you uncomfortable and stuff that you tend to run from. I would like to think that I think the podcast really breaks down these obstacles that people are finding with mindfulness. And mindfulness isn't about meditation, just meditation. Mindfulness is when I'm having a conversation with you, I'm giving you my presence. I'm not looking at my phone. I'm looking you in the eye. I'm listening to you. Mindfulness is having your dinner and not shoving up your nostrils because you have to go to five-a-side football. It's chewing, it's tasting. So mindfulness is about just being present. It's not necessarily about meditating. And if you struggle with the meditation side of it, just try and get more present throughout your day. The shower in the morning, don't listen to your headphones in the walk to work, feel your feet in the ground, become really present. And that's a great way to get into it, and it's a very organic way to get into it.
Great. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining me, Niall Breslin, the podcast Where Is My Mind. Thanks
so
many
for that.